Well, that's the poem again. From the eternal sea, he rises, creating armies on either shore. That was the beginning of it.
And theologians have already interpreted the eternal sea as meaning the world of politics. The sea that constantly rages with turmoil and revolution. So the devil's child will rise from the world of politics.
Hello, listening people.
Hey.
Hello, Bartek, how are you doing?
Good.
All right, and I am also doing very well. And my name's Ryan, and I host, along with my good Polish friend Bartek, this podcast known as Spit and Polish, and we are presenting to you our weekly discussion in which we go over movies that come recommended, and the name of that is Pictures Powwow.
Presented by Polish and Spit.
That's right. I always appreciate the people who call our podcast Spit and Polish and not Spit and Polish. Like, it's one of those things where you hear which one they want to emphasize. Do they want to emphasize the original play on words of, you think it's the usual phrase of spit and polish, like I'm polishing something off, but now they are deeply aware that we are in fact Polish, and so you hear certain folks when they recommend the podcast or when we guest on other podcasts call us Spit and Polish Presents, and it's like, well, yeah, like technically you're correct. It's the same word, but it's just the pronunciation is a bit different, isn't it? Because English is fun. Unlike the Polish language, I don't speak Polish, never will. Never will.
Until you do, and then it's a Polish surprise.
That's what they call Christmas in Poland. A Polish surprise.
Ever since we did that film and you put that in the beginning, I just keep to myself just saying Polish surprise.
When we covered the Polish film.
Yeah.
The only film from Poland we have ever covered, which was its name?
Puszczy, or In Desert and Wilderness.
In Desert and Wilderness. But we are not talking about that today. Today we are talking about a film that has come recommended from the listening people. And which listening person recommended this, Bartek? Who, in fact, propositioned this film for us? And what film was it that was given?
It was Maria.
Santa
Maria.
Santa Maria. why and what do they recommend?
So Maria is a person that I sometimes work with, and she was driving me home a couple of weeks ago, and she was telling me about how she's really into horror films and asking me, like, oh, you know, well, what horror films have you seen? Have you seen this one? Have you seen that one? She was just listing classic after classic after classic, and as people who have listened to this podcast for a while know, I kind of came in late to horror films. Still haven't really seen all that many. So it was a lot of like, oh yeah, I've heard good things about that one, but I haven't seen it. She's like, oh, you got to see this one. And then she specified, like, oh, if you got to see any of them, it's got to probably be the original Omen. So I said, all right, I'll put it down.
And so you did. And here we are to talk about the original Omen, starring Gregory Peck, everyone's favorite actor. Gregory Peck? You know of Gregory Peck, of course, don't you, Bartek?
Yeah.
You ever seen him in anything before, or was this your first Peck?
Might be my first, well, not my first Peck, my first Peck's Josh Peck, but my first Gregory Peck, probably.
You've never seen To Kill a Mockingbird?
No, I think we've got a DVD of it lying around.
Wow, wow, wow. Wowie, wow. You've never seen The Boys from Brazil, in which he plays Joseph Mengele?
No, I don't think we have a DVD.
Wow, real disappointment there.
Sorry, I came late to Gregory Peck.
You are late. You have seen his grandson before, which will relate to things in this discussion. His grandson, Ethan Peck,
he was in
played
something.
Young Kelso in that 70s show.
Right.
Whenever they flash back to when they were younger, he played young Kelso. And guess what Ethan Peck does now? He plays young Spock in Strange New Worlds, the Star Trek series. And he's really buff.
I'm such a big fan of him in that.
He's so buff. And I'm not joking. He's really buff. And it's like distracting that Spock, you know, String Bean, Leonard Nimoy, his younger version is a buff guy. And I just can't comprehend it. But But outside of talking about buff men and Gregory Peck and how this is Bartek's second Peck after Josh Peck, everyone's favorite, who's no relation to Gregory that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. We are talking,
which is a shame for Gregory Peck.
We are talking about The Omen, and I am just going to rip into it, everyone. If you are not familiar with The Omen, it's a story that I feel has pretty much been synonymous with any satanic horror film. Many people, if you haven't even seen this, you may be familiar with the premise of it, which is a man realizes that his son may in fact be the Antichrist and has to decide whether or not he will murder his own child for the sake of everyone. And it's as simple as that premise, but it's actually much more deep. There's a lot more nuances to it. When walking into this, I've already seen The Omen before, but there's this overwhelming sense of, I guess, distortion that pop culture has put around this movie. Like how, just saying a moment ago about Star Trek, there's this idea of what Captain Kirk is like in pop culture, where he's a punching everyone in the face, womanizer, cowboy, hothead, reckless character. But when you actually watch Star Trek, William Shatner's character is very much a even-headed, like very like stoic, very funny. Yes, he kisses ladies and punches people, but he's a lot more of a diplomat. He's a lot more of what you would assume a Star Trek character is. And I feel like that distortion has happened with The Omen, where a lot of the images of this, a lot of the remakes and stuff, and people talk about evil child. It's all about Damien. The image of Damien in his little schoolboy cap and his blazer on the little tricycle, and he's riding around killing people and he's smiling evilly. That like, I feel like The Omen has this image of it's about the evil child doing evil things. And when revisiting this last night, I kind of forgot how little Damien is in this film. Mm. Like, he only serves the function when needed. He's barely in the film, and it's mainly following the father, played by Gregory Peck, and him having to go through this odyssey in a way of breaking away from his denial of what could be going on into believing, and then what does he do from there once he believes his son could be the bringer of destruction?
Yeah, he's built up as like a seed that's been planted and will one day be the thing that makes everything go to shit. But for now, he's a five-year-old boy.
And our lead character is the father, and you're watching a, although powerful man, he's a political figure, you're watching, honestly, just a normal person have to comprehend something that is so beyond the scope of everyday life. And he approaches things from a very pragmatic point of view, and I thought that was thoroughly entertaining. But I just wanted to own up of, even though I've seen this film before, like once or twice over the years, I must admit, even having seen it before, that pervasiveness,
the pop culture has colored your memories
of Damien being like a Children of the Corn type figure, has really kind of tainted what my understanding of the movie is, even though I had seen this before. Now, with yourself, are you that familiar with The Omen? Had you seen this before? Did you know much about it? Was there anything here that was familiar? Was it all new?
Well, I've already talked about if I've seen it or not before. Mm-hmm. I haven't. In a very general sense, I suppose I'm familiar with the premise. It's quite similar to Rosemary's Baby, which I have seen, and that's also on our list. And I suppose I've seen little bits here and there of it referenced in pop culture, but never actually seen it proper. But, you know, hearing that, like, oh, it's about, like, a antichrist as a child, there was sort of, in a minor way, some baggage that I brought in where, like, you know, when you first see the baby and it's being held, it's like, if you took that scene completely out of context, it's like, oh, look, a family with a baby and they're happy and, you know, yay, this is a uplifting film. There was a thought in the back of my mind, like, ooh, what's, I know that baby's going to be evil. Like, what's it thinking right now? And there is just this sense early on where it's like, you know, maybe it really is just a normal baby. for now, having normal thoughts, and like it will get corrupted or something like that. It's not something where, you know, evil things are happening right from the beginning. There is a sort of unease from early on. We have the song happening in the credits. We have a couple of fake out stings, like when the where's Damien? Oh, he's by the tree. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like a stereotypical slasher horror-y kind of thing or anything like that.
Of the standards after this film came out, this is very much a 1970s horror film in which, yes, there's violence in it, and I must say that the violence, the deaths, the murders were still very grisly. I found them very confronting and impactful and with weight. But a lot of 1970s horror is like with The Exorcist, say, which definitely influences why The Omen exists, as does Rosemary's Baby, which is a 1960s film. But the 70s, I feel like a lot of them were about the interpersonal slash family drama. And that's what really is taking up the time in The Omen. Yes, you get haunting images and an amazing score from Jerry Goldsmith that brings you into the trappings of the genre, but a lot of films from this era, whether it is The Wicker Man or Don't Look Now or The Exorcist, is living within the framework of their given horror settings, but it's mainly you following a character or a series of characters approaching things from a very just normal stance. They're not doing the Freddy or Jason type protagonist moves where they're just dumbly walking into things just to be meat. Like, no one in this film is just meat like in a Friday the 13th film.
Yeah.
Everyone is coming from this truly bizarre set of circumstances as just average, normal people. They even break away from being, some of them break away from being the trope that you thought they were. I mainly am talking about David Warner's character, the photographer. He starts the film, and he's so sleazy and opportunistic and selfish. Like, he's always taking photos, and you maybe are expecting him to be the wormy character who's here just to profiteer off of the horrors going on. But he becomes one of the most noble people within the movie.
Yeah, when you think back on it, like, he is, like, always there. He's always taking photos without permission, but he doesn't say too much. Usually it's just like, oh, thank you, things like that.
He just has a demeanor, the smile, smirk, the body language.
You're putting things onto him, but then once he actually starts talking and investigating, it's like, oh, no, this guy's, you know, very thoughtful. He's gonna be very different from, you know, as you were saying, he's not gonna just be meat.
That's it. He's not just gonna be meat, although he does have the best death in the film, one of the most audacious. Let's just agree on that. But I loved The Omen last night when I was watching it. I was so glad with it. I must admit, my memories of this has always been a bit of just a fog. There are other 1970s horror films or satanic panic horror movies that I gravitate towards. Like The Wicker Man, for instance, is one that I really like that deals with the new world versus the old world, and having a central male lead who is very determined. That film's funnier, so that's also why it sticks out. But something like The Exorcist as well, in which you have this idea of a demon possession, and you watch a mother try and solve it in the most logical ways possible, and it's not working, and so she has to turn to the church. And I always kind of looked at The Omen as just lesser in the tier list of these movies. But when I was sitting down last night and watching it, I was just marveling at it. I was just so in awe of it. I was just absorbing the film grain and the score and Gregory Peck's perfect straight man delivery of this. Like, everyone is on the same page of how to play this film. Everyone is in agreement of what the tone should be. It's very serious, and yet it still has that bombast, like that bombacity that is required, like when the priest gets impaled. Like, that's a bombastic sequence. And yet, I would never say that this film entered the realm of cheesiness. Not in my eyes, at least.
No, I was reading a lot of trivia. People were saying, like, oh, you know, it is kind of cheesy. Like, I think Siskel and Ebert both gave it, like, 2.5 out of 4, saying, you know, it's good, but it gets a little bit corny at times. I'm like, I really didn't see it that way. I actually really appreciated, you know, especially thinking about a lot of the horror films we've done in spooky months in recent years, like, this one does feel really grounded in the real world. And I know that we've done, you know, a fair number of horror films where, you know, the style of filmmaking or the thought behind it was like, oh, don't have anything overtly supernatural happen on screen so that you can have like the, you know, is this in their mind or is this actually happening? Like, this film also does that too. And they talk about in trivia, like, yeah, we can't show Satan. We got to be vague like that. And it was interesting that they did this in a way where it was also wasn't as stylized as, say, the Innocence, where that one was also set in, you know, the real world and not showing anything overtly. And you can argue, well, is it like this or is it like that? But this one, yeah, it feels very much like for the first like 15, 20 minutes, other than like the musical stings and all that, it really just does look like you're watching a regular life playing out.
Yeah, I would also just say that what I love about the direction is the subtlety of it, of Richard Donner, who is a well-known director. He did the Superman films. It's not tipping its hand at the start of it being like a horror movie outside of the opening credits, which obviously with the font and the music playing and the image of the boy's silhouette and the shadow that he has being a cross, like that's with the red light, that's all ominous. But when you're actually seeing what Gregory Peck is going through and Damien and all of that, what Richard Donner does is, and he does this throughout the movie and it gets even more and more, which is he lets shots linger just a little bit longer than you would, just a little bit. And as the movie goes on, there's this, I want to say space in the film. There's a languid quality to The Omen. And I say that as a positive. I always think of with 1970s films, they have this very, pedestrian way of approaching things. They're just walking through the garden. We talked about that with Silent Running, where Silent Running will just have scenes and you think, oh, the scene would cut now. But it just goes a little bit longer. And I think it added to the eeriness of The Omen, where even at the beginning, there's just certain scenes that have a bit more of a lethargic pacing to them that I think overall benefits the mentality of the movie. And so when we go further in, that gets more exaggerated, but the music gets faster. That's the thing that I really like. There's a lot of deliberate use of pacing from the visual standpoints, from the actors' deliveries to the music. Like, think about how the nanny, for instance, the replacement one, the governess, how when she first enters the film, she speaks at a normal pace, like a little bit off, but maybe she's just English. But by the end of it, she's saying like a sentence and it's spread out over like a minute, like just so much pause between her words and just this look on her face where there's just no emotion going on. And I think the film really escalates that as it goes along. And I really was noting that down on my watching of it.
Yeah, now that you mention it, yeah. Yeah, she was great. The Miss Baylock, I think it was.
Yeah, she was a fantastic performance.
Yeah, like you said, when she first appears, she's just playing it very professional, almost like a, you know, Mary Poppinsy, Nurse Ratchety kind of thing going on. And as it goes on, like, you, even at the end of that very first scene where it's like, I'm here to raise thee or whatever it was, protect thee, my lord.
She was great.
Yeah.
She's one of those ones where you wish you could play that character because there's so much fun.
It was interesting reading the trivia about the actress too and like the choices behind it. Like one thing was You know, going back to the thing like, oh, we don't want anything too overtly, you know, supernatural or evil happening, but like we kind of fucked up with this character because just look at her performance.
Who cares? It's awesome.
And then also the fun little thing of like, oh, she kind of wanted to pull out, but like she waited too long and no one was able to answer the phone, so she had to do the movie.
And it was all the better for it. And yeah, it helped her career out even till the very end. I was mentioning at the end of the last discussion, or maybe off mic, I cannot recall, I said, have you seen Hot Fuzz before? And Bartek, you're like, yes, I've seen Hot Fuzz, but it's a bit vague. Hot Fuzz references this movie a ton. The most overt would be the death of the priest with the church, where in Hot Fuzz, they have their own version of that, in which the reporter in that film gets decapitated because someone removes like the top of the church, like they just take a bit of like the tip of the tower off of it and throw it down and it lands on his head and he's got that same framing physically and then he falls over. But the Miss Baylock, she's in Hot Fuzz and she plays the innkeeper, the person that that Simon Pegg has to sign in to stay in the village.
Yeah,
and
vaguely remember.
And she's very much playing back to this role in The Omen. And it's a nice little wink and a nudge for those who know who she is and what she is remembered for. And see, that film, Hot Fuzz, is not doing The Omen, but it has enough of the DNA of it where it can do its own thing. But back to the topic at hand here. Talk us through a bit more about your viewpoints and experiences of The Omen, where, yes, you may have understood the basic premise of it, but how did it all spin out for you? What did you get out of this? Well, tell us a bit more.
So from what I recall when Maria was telling me about the film, I think she did talk a little bit about the sequels. And I think I remember her saying that apparently in the sequels, like, oh, you know, the Damien is still around and he's like kind of furthering his career. So I did walk into this knowing like, okay, Damien's going to live through the film, which isn't too big of a shock for horror films where, you know, the villain wins at the end. So I there was an expectation of me like, okay, like what you said, maybe you'll be seeing a lot of Damien in the film. But I really, really liked that, yeah, it focused on our main character really for all of it. I think Damien barely has any lines until like near the end. Mm-hmm. Like he might scream or whatever throughout the beginning part of it, but really he is just a device or a threat of what is to come in the future if he is not stopped. It was a really kind of fresh take on like, oh, this is what you can do with a horror villain. It's like the things happening around where, yeah, there is a sort of curse happening that is killing people. And there is the evil nanny that is also causing trouble or assisting Damien.
There was also, I found, very much ahead of its time. Now, I'm not going to claim that this is the first to do this, but it's definitely an early example of it in my catalogue of films, which is the deaths themselves are indirect. It's through a series of Rube Goldberg-type scenarios in which this thing does this and this and this, and there's only a few that you could make maybe a direct thing, but even then, it's so nebulous to connect it to Damien. And we're so familiar with that with, say, the Final Destination films, in which those characters are deeply aware that there's this, that death is after them, but how is it going to happen? And you get this, like, oh, this handbrake went off on the car, and there was no way to be able to say, like, well, actually, Damien made that happen. Well,
for us, the film to point out is Wish Upon.
Wish Upon is a great example. But even then, this movie doesn't make that direct exposition of, like, well, you see, Damien's powers make it so that you just get David Warner and the photographs, and now he's connecting these weird visual anomalies in his photographs to the deaths that will happen, including to himself. And so there's foreshadowing there. They're playing fair with the audience, but it's just a unique way, especially for the time, of having kills, because you could make it just the kid is killing people. You could make it that the kid is riding his tricycle killing people, and that would be a way to do it. Many of the other Omen sequels or remakes have it much more direct of evil kid does evil things and has stoic blank face, but I really was taken in by just how these people all died brutally, and most of the time it was just unfortunate circumstances. You know, just one or two of them was like, well, they were murdered, but the rest of them, you're like, oh, well, just unfortunate how that happened, huh? That rod came off the church there and impaled that priest. Oh, that's just unfortunate.
Yeah, especially after the past 5 minutes of him, like, dodging lightning and falling trees and fires. Really,
yes.
Unfortunate set of accidents.
Unfortunate set of accidents. But yeah, it's so over the top, and yet I find it much more sensible than if Damien threw a rod from a church roof.
Well, even then, like, what I'm saying is, Damien isn't just the only antagonist in the film. I really enjoyed, actually, that the film has the whole 666 thing,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, in pop culture and, you know, certain spirituality stuff, we know, like, oh, that's the mark of the devil, the 666.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never actually looked into what the 666 meant. I know that it had, like, some sort of connection to, like, Nero Caesar or something like that, but I really didn't know much about it. And I think the David Warner character in this film talks about, like, oh, he did some research, and the 666 refers to, like, the evil holy trinity, mm-hmm. of, like, the I think it was, like, Satan, the Antichrist, and the false prophet. I'm like, mm-hmm. oh, I've heard all those terms before, but I've never heard them, like, put together as, like, a specific trinity. Like, yeah. That actually makes a lot more sense. And it's funny that I don't think I hear that specific explanation a lot in other media.
It's true. I see your point there. And then you have the other person who gives our main character the appropriate tools to kill Damien.
Mm.
He also talks about the mark of the beast, mark of the devil, and how if it's not on the skin, it's under the hair, because that's how... like,
it's in a secret part of the skin.
It's a secret, yes. That's how devious this child is. But, and I will mention that the actor who played the man that gave the tools to kill Damien is uncredited in this, but he was an Australian actor, and he played the best number two in the TV series The Prisoner. So
I was happy to see him.
So he was Leo McKern, and he played the more recurring number two in the 60s series, The Prisoner.
Yeah, I've only seen a couple of episodes, and I remember one of them had an Australian.
He was in. You probably have seen it. He was in the last two episodes of The Prisoner, but he was the other one he was in was The Chimes of Big Ben.
Yep, that's one of the ones I saw.
Where he's the most jovial number two.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm having an art exhibition about me.
Yeah,
get to make artworks about me.
I think in high school we studied the first two episodes than that one.
And he looks the exact same as he does here. The goatee, the long hair. If you look at his image of him in the
same hair color?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if you go back and have a look, I immediately recognized him. I'm like, oh, obviously he's like several years older, but he looks the same.
It's been...
Which is funny because in the last episode of The Prisoner, they shot that later and he looked different. So with a reason for why he looked different in The Prisoner in the last episode, where he had short blonde hair and a mustache.
In my own time, I did watch the last episode. I remember it being weird.
Oh, yeah. You need to watch the second last one. It's even weirder.
Is that true? Wow.
Yeah. Well, depends. Yeah. I found it weirder, but also they're both equally
my
strange.
Teacher did not tell me that.
Now, yeah, the Omen, the score won an Oscar. Jerry mm-hmm. Goldsmith, he's a well-known name. I know him for doing Star Trek music. He did the Star Trek music in the motion picture, and his theme was reused for Star Trek The Next Generation. You've most likely heard the Star Trek Next Generation theme music.
I think I know what it is,
and that's Jerry Goldsmith, and he had a large roster of work, but this is the one that nabbed him an Oscar. Only time. He'd been nominated so many times, but never won, except for this film, and it's great. I loved it. It's a great theme. Those songs are great.
Well, the song didn't win.
No, but the theme, all of that stuff is just really good. It's the Omen was nominated for was the music and the song. I think that's the only stuff it was nominated for.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And that's such a shame because there's so much else going on here now.
With the song, like, I have heard it before, mm-hmm. but obviously I haven't seen the film before, so I've heard it in, being put in other places, so... I have heard it before in a more, I guess, comedic context. And usually when that happens, you get the sense that, like, oh, okay, if I see this in its original context, it won't hit as hard because, you know, I've seen it over Yu-Gi-Oh! Footage or whatever, so it's going to be kind of silly. But, no, it really hit both opening credits and ending credits. Like, it was really powerful.
Do you recall what you had maybe had heard it in before?
I'm pretty sure it was Yu-Gi-Oh! The Abridged Series.
Oh, was? I thought you were just using that as a joke statement. Okay.
No,
I'm used to you being like, it was from Grand Theft Auto.
Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, it was from...
it could have been on like the classical music station.
Yeah, sure. But the score is phenomenal. It's a character in itself. It's ever-present and... Recently, I discussed how ever-present scores can be hit or miss with Bicentennial Man, in which James Horner, another composer who's known for doing Star Trek music, his score was too much in Bicentennial Man. So why does it work here in The Omen? Why does it work? Why does it benefit the film to have the music be constant or looming or ever-present to be carrying most of the scenes? Why is that? And I have a hard time being able to pin it down. I think it just matches tonally whatever the scene is, and it gives it that escalation that you require from the post-production, where... Say, for instance, the fight scene between Gregory Peck at the end with Miss Baylock. It's not a thrilling scene, visually speaking. It's very matter-of-fact. Both actors are doing the choreography as best they can. It's not exciting choreography. It's not scary when they're about to stab each other with stuff. It's not shot and composed from the visual standpoint in the most, dynamic fashion. But you put that music over it and it completely recontextualizes and revamps the scene, makes it something filled with tension. And I think it's the fact that the score always has a deliberate purpose in every single scene it's used in. It doesn't just feel like it's insistent. It doesn't feel like it's there because the audience cannot take scenes without music in it. While some other films I've complained about, I do get that sense where we have to have music playing right now because the audience may be too dumb to realize what we're doing, or we're afraid of letting there be silence. You talked about that last week. Yes.
Where the music didn't shut up, yes. I think you said.
The music, I felt like, was speaking here for a reason rather than just yabbering away in the background.
The music had something to say.
It had something to say and made me feel things. Like, the cacophony of noise in The Omen is so specific because most of the time, even with the music, it's people talking in rooms. People talking in rooms. People talking on a road. People talking in a car. But then you get smashed in the face with like 40 dogs barking and howling and music is swelling and Gregory Peck's arm is stabbed through a fence and he's screaming in pain and David Warner's camera is the shutter's going off and you hear people like you hear him falling over in the dirt scraping around and like my ears are ringing from how insane
you know
this
what?
Is but you know what it worked. That's like
you were saying before about like lingering for too long. I remember that scene like they'd driven away and it just stayed on those dogs barking for ages, and I'll admit part of it was me not wanting to get up and turn the volume down, but I was just waiting for it to cut away, like, come on, please. Enough.
It was a highlight of the film.
It was pretty. It was, yeah, it was crazy. A lot of the animal stuff in this was pretty crazy.
And the brutality of finding an infant skeleton in the grave.
With a hole in its skull.
The hole in its skull that they killed the child, evidently, clearly. And David Warner getting like mauled by dogs. There's blood coming off of these two men as they've been bitten by dogs and Gregory Peck's arm is stabbed through the gate, and he can't get down. He can't support his own weight either, and you just hear like flesh tear. It's ugh.
Mm.
Still effective. I mean, what did you think about the kills, the deaths, and the overall use of violence in this? Because at least from my point of view, it's of its time. Violence, how it's presented in horror movies like a decade later or now, is very different to what you get in The Omen. But what did you think of them? And did you have a particular death that struck a chord with you?
I think mostly because it was kind of the tone setter of the film. Maybe just the first death of that first nanny, where, like we were saying, the beginning of this film, it is very normal outside of the, you know, ominous music and all that and the fake stings. You are just seeing, you know, family has moved to England because dad's the ambassador. They've got a house. They've got nanny. They're having a birthday party and everyone's dressed nice and it's the 60s. Mm-hmm. Yay. And
70s,
then,
yeah.
60s plus 10.
Thank you.
By St. Helmy, in 2 years.
Got his ass.
Right, and editing, don't do anything, just laugh at me. It is the 70s, and you're watching the scene play out, and then you're just hearing a voice going like, Damien, Damien. It's like, oh, who is that?
Nice voice,
yeah, and just very pleasantly, she's like, Damien, it's all for you, and then she just jumps, and, you know, you get a really loud sound effect of the window smashing, and it's just like, whoa, okay, so this is kind of the level of horror that we're going to get in this film where, yeah, it isn't, you know, a monster comes out, it isn't, you know, a demonic aura appears and, you know, bad things happen. It's just something very bluntly will happen in the middle of, you know, a normal day, and that kind of follows through later on in the film when more deaths happen, like the priest who gets skewered by the church spire, he had a, you know, normal conversation and then things just went to shit as soon as that conversation was over. David Warner, when he had his death, which, as you said, probably is the highlight of the film when it comes to, you know, the deaths, we learned like maybe 20, 25 minutes before his death that, like, you know, he's going to be the next to die. And there is a sense that, like, you're waiting for it to happen. When's it going to happen? Is it going to be during the climax? You know, is he going to make it, you know, to the next scene? And he's having this discussion with Gregory Peck, conversation. It's like, he says some innocuous line that doesn't sound like a last line. It's like, well, I'll take it into my own hands or something
killing
like that.
Killing the child, because Gregory Peck cannot. He cannot do it because he has a soul and a conscience. And David Warner says, well, fuck that. I will kill the child then. And he runs after these tools that...
Yeah, but what I'm saying, like, the literal line, he says, like, well, then I'll take it into my own hands. And then there's not a single line of dialogue happens again until he's killed off.
A lot of the deaths are, of course, very showy because it's a film, but also there's a mix of, they're very, by design, like I mentioned, the way that the kills happen, unceremonious.
Mm.
David Warner gets his head cut off. It does like several spins in the air, which is very great. Like, what a lucky shot that was, because that's a prop, you know, you don't, it's no CG to control that.
So it was a fun trivia point about that.
And yes, there is. And his head falls and you see he gets a look as he's those final 2 seconds while the brain is still registering his own reflection of his severed head. And it's just very unceremonious. Like, you liked that character. You felt for that character. Now you got the quick pop hit of seeing him die in a very gruesome way. And then you're just left there with he's gone. And that happens with the wife as well. I actually found her death to be the most impactful because she was trying to live so hard, like, please don't let Damien kill me, is one of the many lines she kept saying to Gregory Peck, like, when he was, after she had first got fucked up from Damien, she's, like, in the hospital or wherever she is, and she's like, don't let him kill me. And that's why he goes off and does his thing, and then she gets killed by Baylock, and she gets thrown out the hospital window, she falls so hard, she smashes through an ambulance, onto the gurney that you would be on in the ambulance if they were taking you to the hospital, blood, and you just have a phone call where you only hear Gregory Peck's lines about how she died and how this is like the thing that breaks his character. Like he can never recover from this and he's already suffered so much. I found that one particularly impactful, but...
Well, I think going back to the David Warner one, why that one hits so hard too, is that other than the parents' deaths in the film, so we'll just look at the wife since hers happens in the middle, the deaths are very unceremonious kind of when they happen. But David Warner, he's such a fleshed out character and he's, you know, like I said, he's living for quite a long time after, you know, his death is already in the cards, that you do expect that it is going to happen in like a ceremonious moment or, you know, an important moment.
He's a selfless character. Like he goes out of his way to help and protect and save the lead,
yeah.
Even though it could kill him.
He's already subverted the expectation you have of him from the beginning where it's like, oh, okay, you know, this guy's just out for his career. And it does just, most of the scene happens and you don't even know this is it. This is the one where he dies.
You obviously get the tip off when the handbrake lets loose and you're like, okay, now it's happening. But still, it's a lot to take in. The nanny at the beginning is the known kill, the known death. Everyone knows the, it's all for you, Damien, the line delivery. She says it in this very jaunty fashion, almost like she's in a cult herself.
Mm.
That actress is the daughter of Jack Palance. So that's a fun trivia fact.
I did see the Palance name somewhere in the
cast.
She's
the daughter.
Didn't know who was related.
I always think of that death is very much burned into my brain because in the TV series That 70s Show, they're at a drive-in cinema watching The Omen. You don't see it, you just hear it. And you hear that scene. And they all react in terror like, oh my God, except for one person. Kelso, played by Ashton Kutcher, laughing his ass off, like giving the most Ashton Kutcher big grin, throwing the head back, laughing.
You know what?
Pointing at the screen and laughing, thinking it's the funniest thing he's ever seen in his life. And I have to say that may be one of the funniest things Ashton Kutcher got to do on that show is see the, it's all for you, Damien, and just completely lose it at how silly it is in his eyes.
You know, I don't remember the Ashton Kutcher aspect of that episode, but when I heard the line in The Omen, like, it's all for you, Damien, like, I have heard that line somewhere, and there was, like, no proper, like, context for it. It was, like, something that happened off screen, and I could not remember what it was, but I am pretty sure it was that episode.
Mm-hmm. But... what do you think about Gregory Peck? You haven't seen him in anything before. At least you're not that you are aware of. What did you think of him? Because at the time, it's almost like stunt casting in a way. Like get a golden age actor to appear in your 70s, late 70s horror film. And he adds that gravitas to it. But what did you think of him?
I thought he was great. When you look at a lot of, you know, more cheesier horror films, there is often the turn that happens where it's like, oh, the film has turned into the horror film. You know, the characters will be acting a different way from how it begins. This character felt like he was trying to keep it together the whole way through. You know, the film opens on him, you know, just distraught over the fact that his newborn child has died. And he's given a sign from God, as the priest said, of like, you know, there is this child whose mother just died. You can adopt him, take him on, and, you know, live a happy life with him. And then throughout the film, as things are getting worse, he is just trying to keep it together. He's always got this, like, very stern face on. He's always trying to fix the problems, and things are just getting worse and worse. And like you said, he has the breaking point when he finds out his wife dies and he has to, you know, take further steps, actually really consider, like, maybe I have to kill what could be, you know, a human child. And
his own child. In his eyes, still, his for own the majority child. Of the film, he still sees Damien as his son.
And you buy into it. Like, even after you have the scene with number two, makes it sound like we're talking about Austin Powers, with the character that gives
Liam
him the
McKern's
knives.
Character.
Liam McKern's character.
Uncredited, even though he's
uncredited.
In a big scene.
Sorry, I mean, that uncredited guy's character, you know, he sees the birthmark, and when he is finally at that church, you know, holding him down with the knife, you can see the struggle on his face, and yeah, you are now looking at a child who's fearing for their life, and it's like, could there still be a mistake here? He's struggling, and you really buy into it.
Any film, whether they're horror, fantasy, science fiction, romance, whatever the thing is, you have subtext there. You have an underpinning, you have a theme, you have something beneath the surface. So on the surface, this is about a film of a father realizing his son is the Antichrist and must kill the devil child. What it's really about, the real horror, is not about how the son is evil, demonic, and kills people. The real horror is about a father having to kill his own child, or kill a child. And that's what majority of the time is spent on. You're seeing Gregory Peck's character. You're seeing Gregory Peck, the actor, bring in his own personal experiences too. We'll talk about that as well. But a man who loves this child as if they are their own, because of, again, this is an adopted child. And you're seeing him have to really struggle with the idea of having to murder the child. Like, he is nonplussed about the idea that the kid could be demonic after a certain point. He's more worried about, like, actually having to do the deed himself. What does that mean? Like, there's never a conversation in this movie, and I could imagine this being something in a modern film, where you never have a moment where he questions or challenges the idea that this could be a trick to damn him, or this is a trick of some ludicrous form. He is questioning of if this is true or not, but he never has that, like, bullshit, like, maybe they're trying to trick me into killing my own child. Like, no.
Hmm.
Well, he's more worried about actually what that would actually look like, what that actually would feel like, what that the actual end of the film for him, of the reality of holding a knife and going to stab your own fucking kid. And he is going to do it at the end, but he's still like, God help me. Even though his character isn't religious throughout this. That's another interesting little wrinkle, is it's not like they're anti-religious, they're just not particularly religious. So it's kind of fun to watch this, let's just call them agnostic family, get thrown into a religious drama and see how they try.
Yeah, they see a church and they're like, it's just a church.
But no, Gregory Peck, it's obvious to say he was one of the great actors. He's one of the known actors of that time, of that era, of the era he was from. He had a versatility, and yet he also had the things you know Gregory Peck for. The voice is one of the things. The eyebrows is another, but the square jaw type thing. But he was a very versatile actor. He would do Atticus Finch, and then a few years earlier, he was Captain Ahab. You know, like, completely different type of characters. Or he'll do romantic comedies with Audrey Hepburn. Like, he did Roman Holiday, which I know you haven't seen, but it's one of those where if I showed you some iconic scenes from it, you will be like, oh, I saw that sent up in Down With Love or something. Like, it's one of the, like, he could do a Cary Grant type performance if need be. Like, he was just a very strong performer. And in the later part of his career, or like midway career, because this guy lived to like the late 90s and was still acting, he even did another Moby Dick thing at the end, but he was always trying to do something different. And in the 70s, in the late 70s, he kind of hit this point in which he was at a fuck it, I'll try whatever. So he did The Boys from Brazil, which got poor reviews, poor reception at the time, considered a classic now, but at the time he was slammed for not being very good in it. Nowadays it's considered one of his best, so one of those things. But this is another example in which he, like, who would expect Gregory Peck to do The Omen? Like, who would expect Atticus Finch to do the, you know what I'm talking about? But he saw a script, he saw an opportunity, and he had some personal kind of feelings about it, because you've read the trivia, you know about this too.
A million points, like the year prior, his in real life, his son committed suicide.
And he felt a partial guilt about that, it seems. And like going into some more trivia about him and his life, you know, he was out and about like doing acting, doing activism, doing all of this stuff. I would really highly, like, this is a people who know Gregory Peck's story, this is clear as day, but if people, you don't know much about Gregory Peck, read up on the guy. Fascinating figure, like truly fascinating. He's one of those where each time I found a trivia fact about him, I was just like, wow, really, Gregory Peck? Like, mastered Martin Luther King. Okay. And just like, was against the Vietnam War. All right. Although his own son was enlisted in it. He was still supportive of his son, but hated the war. Okay. When Columbine happened, he got really mad that the US government failed to stop clamping down on guns. Okay, yeah, Gregory like Peck.
Forrest Gump, who was always at everything.
Gregory Peck, he just couldn't stop being like progressive in these. There's like one quote where it was like Gregory Peck on gay marriage. And I was like, oh no. And it was like, and his whole quote was like, basically like, I don't get why this is a fight that needs to exist when it's just the right thing to do. Or he was deeply Catholic, right? I'm like, okay. And then one of his quotes about being deeply Catholic is, I agree with the church about a lot of things. I think there's some things that they could open themselves up about, like gay marriage, abortion, just like all these hot button topic issues. Like, what the fuck, Gregory Peck?
He's a time traveler.
Yeah, but you know, he's also a guy of his time. But is there any other things you wanted to flag up about The Omen? Anything that you wanted to break apart or bring up?
I feel like there was.
There's a lot here.
There is, yeah.
Do you find now in 2024 with your life experiences, even though you're not a big horror aficionado, the satanic panic stuff or the Satan horror, how do you digest that? Because in the 70s, we already referenced some that obviously helped spark this off. And since then, it's been a big thing that's come and gone. Like every genre has like its thing it's interested in. Like when we were in high school, it was all about paranormal activity. And now we kind of look at that stuff with a little bit of an eye roll going, okay, can we move on from that? But how do you feel about like the Satan horror stuff? Are you a fan of it? Do you enjoy how it was used here? Do you think it's a bit played out nowadays? Like, what do you feel?
Well, for this one, I liked that, you know, there wasn't really a cult aspect to it. Because usually in these satanic panic type stories, you do have like cults and believers. And
it's unspoken.
Yeah.
Because you have Miss Baylock and you have the priest who was burnt that gave them the child in the first place. Like there is this understanding, but it's not really spoken aloud that there is a cabal of Satanists that orchestrated this to happen, but it doesn't get weighed down.
Well, usually it falls down to like an organization. Like it wasn't, you know, this film wasn't quite, the film I'm about to reference wasn't really, you know, a satanic panic one, but Starry Eyes. Like eventually you get the sort of satanistic ritual at the end where like all the Hollywood elites gather around and it's like, oh yeah, it always comes down to, you know, a big group. I think even Paranormal Activity 4 kind of ended in a similar sort of way where it's like, oh shit, a big group. But yeah, this one, like I said, it really condenses and really focuses in on this family. Like we do have scenes of just the mother without Gregory Peck, but it is mostly, yeah, the Gregory Peck story. And for a lot of the film, specifically the chunk where he's partnered up with David Warner, it is almost like a little bit of in an odd way, like an adventure film. Like a lot of the problems back home are kind of at a standstill where it's like, oh, the nanny's looking after Damien, my wife's in the hospital. There's nothing immediately that I have to do there. I can travel around Europe with this guy to sort of unravel the mystery and, you know, find out the answers to these questions. And that really lends itself to not really feeling like such a typical horror film, which, yeah, that I really gravitate towards that. If this was more of a typical, like a satanic panic film where you're dealing with the believers. Like that's one thing with Rosemary's Baby. It's like this friendly old couple who
the entire apartment block. Like there's a friendly old couple and all of their friends and everyone. And even the husband. Yes. Even the guy, he was in on it too. Like, everyone in the film is in on it.
Yeah, it's like there's it's a conspiracy where there isn't really all that many physically existing players.
Mm.
It's like, it's the couple that we have and, you know, Satan, who's off in hell or whatever.
Although the Exorcist and the Exorcist doesn't have that either. It's just the forces that be, and most people don't even believe in it because why would they? Like, at that point, like, exorcism in the Catholic Church was considered like a shameful joke that they don't actually like employ, except for one loser priest that's off in the Andes. Like, that's a thing. With this, I think another thing that really leapt out at me is it has the down ending. The Satan wins.
Mm.
And that's like Rosemary's Baby as well, where that's a film where evil wins, seemingly at least. And that's this film as well, where evil wins and it will become the president, probably, or become, you know, high up in power.
Yeah, like,
and you get the child just smile at us, being like, yeah, I'm a little shit.
You have the angle of like, oh yeah, Damien lived, but you have the juxtaposition of all these other things. Like, you get the, you got the exposition earlier where it's like, oh, the quote in Revelations, it was referring to the world of politics. And now, not only has Damien lived, he's literally holding hands with the President of the United States. You can kind of connect the dots of like, oh, this is what's next for him.
And our lead character also dies unceremoniously. We know he dies, and, you know, stop our shoot, bam, and it holds on that. And then we just cut to the coffins. It's happened. It's done. We're moving on.
Yeah, it's dramatic but not ceremonious. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Like, that's our main character who just got killed. And we're moving on. It reminded me of Reservoir Dogs, actually, that little bit at the end where they're like, hold it or I'll blow you away or whatever. And it makes me think of how that film goes as well.
See, and that death, because that was the death, you know, the police officer shot him. That one really wasn't an accident. That one was like directly tied to his actions. So it's like, even fate itself seems to be against him.
Yes.
In that moment,
and
at least.
And that's The Omen. Another thing that I will mention, or else my sci-fi fans will get up in arms. Father Brennan, the priest that got impaled, was the second Doctor of Doctor Who. He was Patrick Troughton, who was in a million things as well, but he's known as the second Doctor in Doctor Who. So you know how Doctor Who works, where whenever they want to recast the Doctor, they just regenerate the Doctor. Well, he was the first regeneration of the Doctor because the original one was getting old and had health problems, but they wanted the show to keep going. So then they made this sci-fi conceit of, oh, when he dies, he regenerates into new person. And Patrick Troughton was the second Doctor. So he gets to be in this, and he's not at all funny. In Doctor Who, he was the funny Doctor, the first kind of kooky one. The first Doctor was like old and mean, and he hated his companions and was just very angry all the time. And he was great. I love William Hartnell, but he was a lot more of like a teacher, while Patrick Troughton, he played the Doctor as a vagabond. He looked like a homeless man, and he was like a clown. Like, he was always doing like little magic tricks and stuff. So it was nice to see him in this. And he was very different and very manic.
But weren't you, talking about a different actor, David Warner, weren't you embarrassed for him that he was acting alongside one of the worst actors?
Oh, yes. In Doctor Who, no. He was in a bad Doctor Who episode, so there you go. In more modern Who, where he had to play like a Russian in it. But no, David Warner was a sci-fi actor as well. He was in Star Trek. Babylon 5 is what Bartek's referring to.
I listened to a little bit of your Grail episode because on YouTube, one of the key moments in the description was like, oh, David Warner.
Yes. Yes, David Warner was a great actor. He was in Tron. He was in a million things as well. Like, this is a cast in The Omen made up of performers who are real that person actors or actresses. Like, oh, they were they were in this thing and this thing and this thing. And just, yes, a whole array of talent here in front of and behind the camera as well. But that is our discussion on The Omen. I recommend it.
I do too. This was a really good one. Thank you, Maria.
Due to weird licensing stuff, it's just on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's just on YouTube.
I saw two uploads. One of them is bad quality. Don't watch that one. Watch the other one.
Good. good. I don't know which one it was. I just pressed the first one and it looked great.
I think it's the one that has less views.
There you go. Less
or
views.
Less likes, yeah.
Less views, less likes, less quality.
Early in the film, there's text on screen because there's like credits and stuff. Just watch the one that isn't blurry.
There you are. Thank you very much, Bartek. He's informed me, and now I'm informing you to listen to what Bartek said.
Yeah, you're welcome, Ryan, even though I think I saw you have a copy of the movie.
Well, here's a funny thing. I almost forgot to mention it until just you now said it. Rachel bought me on Blu-ray The Omen from like a secondhand store or wherever. 2006 version of The Omen, not the original.
Oh, that's the remake.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I knew immediately as soon as I grabbed the cover, I went, this is one of those like 2000s horror movies. Like I just knew from like, it had that like sepia brown look on it. I'm like, that's not The Omen. And it isn't. It's the remake with Lee Schreiber and
it's the
others.
Brownman.
The Brownman.
That sounds racist.
Don't say it then.
Yeah.
Don't say it.
Right,
don't
editing,
think it, don't say it.
Make me say it louder.
And quieter at the same time.
The Brownman.
And he said it again. But you are recommending the next film for the discussion on the podcast, Bartek. So
I am.
What is your film of choice? You have all the films in the world, except for not really, because this is your America pick. Am I right?
Nope.
Am I wrong?
Yep.
What was your last one?
My last one was The Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh, that's right. That was American.
So I literally do have most of the world
so
at
you have
my
the
tips.
Whole world. And remember, it's a year of musicals. So what did you
I was
going to
say earlier when we were talking about the score in this film, I'm like, oh, wow, we finally started the world of musicals. Well, Ryan, I want to ask you, do you like musicals?
Yes.
Do you like epics?
Is this a Bollywood?
Answer the question. Do you like epics?
Sure.
Do you like period films?
Sure.
Do you like dramas?
Yes.
Do you like sport films?
Yeah, no. Yeah.
That's a lot of genres. What do we call it when there's so many genres?
Masala?
Yeah, in the context of Indian, it is masala. In other contexts, it might not be. But that's on point. It's an Indian epic period musical sports drama film.
What's the sport? Is it cricket?
Yeah, it is. Cricket. It's cricket.
The least interesting sport.
It's okay. We've talked about how sport films usually...
You've talked about this one on the pod before, I swear.
I've referenced it.
Tell everyone.
The film is called Lagaan. L-A-G-A-A-N.
Is this the one with Aussies in it? I can't recall.
It's got British people in it.
There was some Indian film you watched that had Aussies in it, and you were like, what?
There were a couple that were filmed in Australia. I was an extra in one of them, even.
There you go. So Lagaan.
Lagaan, yes. And similar to when I recommended Doom 2 and you were like, oh, there's got a subtitle that you've never heard of, Bartek. This one does have a subtitle too that I've never heard of, but you know, we'll ignore it. It's just Lagaan, Once Upon a Time in India.
That's a great title. Why are you disregarding that?
It just sounds lame.
Once upon a time in Mexico, once upon a time in Hollywood, once upon a time, you know.
Yeah, doesn't it feel played out?
This was earlier, before, if anything, Tarantino played it out. Which came first?
I suppose. This is a 2001 film.
Wow. What month did it come out?
June.
Oh, so happier times.
June. Oh, the sixth month. Oh.
There we are. 666.
Yeah. Now, Lagaan. I think it says Lagaan. Here means
who's
land.
Who's the lead of this for our Indian heads out there?
So in a lot of the Bollywood films episodes that we've done, I've talked about how there are the three Khans, and we've done a lot of Shah Rukh Khan films. We did one Salman Khan film, and I keep talking about the other one, but we've never done anything with him. That's Aamir Khan. This is finally an Aamir Khan film.
Is this easily available for people to find, or is this a case of Bartek will now hand me a physical copy?
This one is on Australian Netflix.
Yes.
So it's all good, Ryan. I always make sure that you can see the Bollywood films.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Lagaan, everyone, make sure to give it a watch.
Not to be
confused. How long is it? Is it long?
Bollywood length? I don't know.
So the length of an average Marvel film?
224 minutes.
That's long.
Wait, hold on.
224 minutes or 2 hours and 24 minutes?
224 minutes.
That's a long one. That's a long movie, Bartek. That's a long movie. 2 hours is 120 minutes. So give that some thought.
I don't remember it being that long.
It's long.
It's a good film, though. Don't worry.
Guys, we are watching maybe the longest film covered on the podcast? I think we are. So Bartek, why you do mathematics to realize that that's like 4 hours long. we will be watching Lagan in the interim of time, but you can find us on social medias of Facebook and Twitter, Spit and Polish Presents. Recommend us movies and or let us know what you thought about the films that we have discussed on the podcast. Hit us up on those social medias, or you can just directly email us over at
spitandpolished@gmail.com.
Gmail.com, everyone. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast, follow us, listen to us on whatever podcasting site allows you to do so. Some of them are dying. Did you know that? RIP Google Podcasts, RIP iHeartRadio, and several others.
iHeartRadio's dying?
I think, or Radio Public, one of the ones with radio in it. There's a few that are dying. Stitcher doesn't belong anywhere outside of America now, but we're on YouTube. And YouTube is where they're trying to push podcasts, but guess what? We've been there for a while, so you can subscribe to our podcast and find videos on there that aren't available on our main feed of the pod. Little Easter eggs, little nuggets, as we like to call them.
We got a video titled The True Star of Agent Cody Banks 2, and it's a really good video. I don't know if we've monetized it. But
I can't, because it has war, what is it good for?
Yeah, it does have a little bit of that.
But it has an observation I made about that movie that still is very relevant to modern culture today.
Is the death of Fleshrex still up?
The death of Fleshrex. I think the main one that gets flagged is the behind the scenes of that I made of Sorority Boys.
It's the video that plays when you go to our channel. Every time you go there, it's
one of my favorite videos.
Oh, my job. Yeah.
My job. But that is all. Thank you all so much for listening. And remember to be kind to each other, or else I will stab you in a church.
You don't scare me. Fuck you.
How would that have been if Damien said that? In that voice, you don't scare me. Fuck you.
Yeah, that's more of the good son, I guess.
With Macaulay Culkin?
He says fuck you in that, right?
I haven't seen The Good Son.
Me neither. Fuck it. Fuck The Good Son. Fuck.